Mindfulness has become big business in some areas as employers try to boost productivity and cut sick days. But what exactly is it? And can it really be dragooned into economic service without losing some of its essence? If the topic of mindfulness has come up in a work context for you, I'd be very interested to hear, especially if your boss has paid for you to do a mindfulness course. Did it make a difference in your life? Leave us a comment on our Facebook page. The lack of definition is one problem that Dr. Nicholas Van Dam has with the idea. He's a senior lecturer at the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences from the University of Melbourne. But Dr. Craig Hassett has a degree in medicine and teaches mindfulness programs at Monash University. And he says that very flexibility is a strength of the practice. Nicholas, Craig, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Nice to be with you, Hilary.
Now, let's start with you, Dr. Nicholas Van Dam. You and some colleagues recently wrote a paper about how nobody really knows what mindfulness is. What were your concerns about that?
So our concerns were really that people use this term quite broadly. So they say mindfulness and they can mean anything from what you do on a phone app to what you do in a yoga class to what you do on a retreat at a center or to what you do actually at a monastery. So the variety of what people mean when they say mindfulness is quite complicated. And that variety means that we sort of throw this term around and we see it in flashy headlines and people will say things, particularly in research studies or news media reports saying mindfulness does this and that, but they're not always talking about the same thing. So there's lots of different practices that it may sort of invoke or entail. And they may be referring, as I said, to very, very different practices or even sometimes just characteristics of individuals.
Or even a general worldview, approach of mindfulness. Yeah. So just to clarify for the listeners, how big is the hype around mindfulness, especially when it comes to some of the claims being made for what it can do in workplaces?
So I think as a whole, I mean, there's reasonably good evidence that it's probably helpful for a lot of people. There's not a whole lot of stuff in terms of workplace evidence. There's evidence in the context of mental health and well-being more generally. In workplace, it's a little bit more complicated. There have been a number of studies that have sort of looked at this area, looked at sort of whether mindfulness can help people. But it's more on exactly the sort of areas that you would expect, sort of stress reduction, health benefits for individual employees, as opposed to does it make people work more efficiently together in a group context? Does it resolve conflicts? The kind of things that you presumably sort of employers would want to be addressing were they using this.
Well, and some of the websites I noticed that say we can run mindfulness programs in your workplace are like, yep, better mental health of staff, healthier cultures in organizations, higher degrees of creativity and innovation, greater levels of emotional intelligence, stronger levels of personal responsibility and leadership. They're basically revolutionizing these workplaces.
Absolutely. And this is a common thing where you see in a lot of websites and services that are providing mindfulness training of some sort or another. They often conflict the different types of evidence. So they often use, and this is common with a lot of the apps as well, they often use the evidence from structured courses. So say things like mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is an 8-week structured program that entails a lot of face-to-face practice, a lot of home meditation practice, and they'll take evidence from that structured course and they'll then say, we've shown that mindfulness meditation practice changes the brain. And a colleague of mine recently showed me, you know, the latest of the Headspace app's website, and they'll say, you know, a few minutes a day could lead to these same changes. And so it's sort of implying that the same effects you get from doing an 8-week course or from going on a 3-month retreat could be observed, you know, minutes a day. And we really just don't have evidence for that. So I think that's kind of where you see some of the hype is in the way that people are selling and promoting it. They're sort of implying that you can get the same kind of benefits from a few minutes or a short course as you could from sort of a long program or a structured program.
Dr. Craig Hassett, you're not so fussed about the variability of definition. Why is that?
Well, I think there are different ways of delivering mindfulness, and Nicholas was pointing to that, the, you know, longer courses, shorter courses, more emphasis on the meditation side of it, more emphasis on the informal practice, being mindful through yoga. So there's variability in how it's delivered, but I don't see that as necessarily a problem. It's just to be clear about what's been delivered and how. In terms of defining what mindfulness is, its characteristics, and that's quite a difficult thing. There's an old story. I'm not sure exactly what tradition it comes from, but these men, you know, the king blindfolds a number of men, and they go up, and they're each invited to go and touch the elephant. And one, you know, feels the elephant's leg and says it's like a tree. Another one feels a trunk and says it's like a snake. Another one feels, you know, the tail and says it's like a brush and so on. So each one describes differently what they're actually in touch with. And it's not that any are wrong. It's just that it's one particular aspect of it is not the whole picture. So it is a very hard thing to define, because it depends on if somebody emphasizes, well, it's an attentional practice. Well, it can be. It's a practice in emotional regulation. Well, it can be. It's an exercise in greater awareness or developing compassion. It can be. In fact, it can be all those things. A person might practice it for one reason, but other things, as it were, start to change of their own accord.
But isn't it's very hard to tie down. Is it a problem, though, if someone sold you a tree and you whip the blindfold off and you've got an elephant instead?
Well, that's the point. I guess that's the whole metaphor, that often each one describes a different aspect of it, and there's lots of argument and debate, well, who's right and who's wrong? And in a sense, everybody's right. But I think it's the sort of thing that concerns... sometimes it concerns academics or wanting a precise definition, whereas it is a very hard thing to define. And so the whole view of what it is has many, probably an infinite number of aspects if you want to keep looking at it from different perspectives. So that makes it hard for researchers, it makes it hard to define. At the end of the day, people are interested in practicing what might be of use to them in their lives, at their work or at home. And so people, I suppose, in their day-to-day lives just cut through it and start to apply it and find that it can help them in various ways if they're interested to apply it.
Let's look briefly at the downside. Nicholas, if it makes people feel a little bit stressed, is it a problem if they go off and do whatever is being packaged as mindfulness? I mean, are there risks?
Yeah, I think it depends on what they're doing. And sort of, I think one issue that is very clear about, and just as a bit of a follow-up to what Craig said, I think it's true that sort of people can cut through and do these practices. The problem is, what practices are they doing? And if someone markets or sells mindfulness kind of without that clarity, as you said, somebody could be selling you a tree and you're getting an elephant. So, you know, they might be selling off of the claims of what mindfulness-based stress reduction does, but then they're giving you a phone app. And so I think particularly from the perspective of companies or people that are paying for these things, I think that's particularly worrying for me. Now, I think with regards to, could there be side effects? Could there be things that are potentially concerning? Absolutely. I think this is a discussion that's really starting to emerge. Most traditional meditation teachers have known about adverse events for a long time. To quote one person recently who sort of said this to me, why this sort of isn't discussed more widely, it's bad for business. Talking about the fact that people have difficulties and hardships during practice is bad for business. They don't want to discuss it.
And when you say difficulties and hardships, at the extreme end, they can be very dangerous, can't they?
They can be. So you can have things like psychotic breaks. You can have things like anxiety attacks. You can have things like suicidality, sort of increased heightened desires to do things, to harm oneself. It can exacerbate or sort of lead to new depressive episodes or sort of worsening of existing depressive episodes. For people with trauma histories, it can make things worse in terms of their presentation clinically. So there are, for a number of individuals, you know, these are very real things. And, you know, we wouldn't recommend, and my colleagues and I have sort of talked about this a lot, we wouldn't recommend that people sort of just go off and engage in these kind of practices on their own before they've really sort of thought through and talked with their doctor or someone else to sort of see, is it right for them?
And I think when we're talking about that extreme end, often we're talking about really immersive, longer term things. So Craig, possibly not so much a lunchtime mindfulness break, but would you be concerned, Dr. Craig has said, that the trainers who are rolling out workplace mindfulness programs would be able to spot someone who might potentially have a problem?
Well, I think, you know, as you hinted, it's really those significant adverse events tend to be very uncommon, but they do happen, and mostly in the context of intensive practice, not really in the context of people just using it in a much sort of briefer kind of way. And I think that it really does behove a person who's trained in mindfulness or somebody who's looking to bring somebody on board, excuse me a moment, to bring somebody on board into a workplace to make sure that they have good credentials, because mindfulness can be poorly taught. If I could use a sort of a metaphor, if you're going to have an exercise program, then somebody could come in and push people way too hard to exercise. Let's go and do a marathon, and people aren't trained up for it, and you get significant adverse events, and people can have a heart attack. But so if a person's well trained in how to train others, then you start gently and you work up, and a person needs to understand about exercise and to be a good trainer. I think the same with mindfulness. You need to be a good trainer. And when it's being used in a mental health context, I think it raises the bar. A person needs two things: to be very experienced with mindfulness, and secondly, have good mental health credentials. Because if there is something happening for a person and you're not giving them the support and touching base with them, etc., if they're experiencing difficulties, you really do need to be helping them with that, and you need to recognise things sometimes. So I think it's important for trainers to have good training in how to train others.
And Craig, is there an accreditation process for mindfulness coaches, and who oversees that?
Well, there's a few different organisations. There's an international organisation for mindfulness teachers. In Australia, there's Meditation Australia. And the bar is raised the highest for those who are using any form of meditative practice in a therapeutic setting to make sure that person has the right health professional credentials, and also has the highest bar in terms of their training in meditation, instruction. And I think that's a very important thing. I want to put in a footnote as well, that what is far more common for people learning mindfulness, I wouldn't necessarily call adverse events, in the sense that a person's learning it and it's not always easy, and they might get a bit irritated with themselves over the mind wanders. They might have noticed more of the stress or the tension that's in the background that they're not noticing. And that's, I wouldn't necessarily call that adverse events. It comes with the territory in learning how to apply mindfulness. And so the well-trained teacher is just gently helping the person to navigate through that and to learn from their experience so that they move on and become better at it.
Let's look at the workplace specifically in the time that we have left with you. Nicholas Van Dam, Senior Lecturer in Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne, and Dr. Craig Hassett, Associate Professor at Monash University Medical School and Coordinator of Mindfulness Programs at Monash. I should say Dr. Nicholas Van Dam. If we look at the workplace, if people do a mindfulness course there, are they likely to get a full kind of cultural context of the ancient traditions that it springs from, or maybe just bits and pieces?
I highly doubt they would get sort of the full backdrop of where it comes from. I mean, they're probably getting a very customized program that's designed for the workplace, designed to fit in with the schedule at the workplace. So it wouldn't be uncommon, for example, to sort of have this during lunchtime or after hours.
Is that a problem, though?
Well, I mean, it's a problem in the sense that, you know, if you're really trying to offer it to employees and sort of saying, you know, this is something we want you to do, offering it sort of after hours or during lunchtime sort of says you should do this on your personal time. Maybe we're making it freely available, but not during work hours. But my guess would be sort of a lot of these programs, how they're structured and designed, are going to be fairly simple, fairly straightforward. They're not going to have a lot of the additional context. And so it may be helpful. It may be useful. Sort of it may be have some sort of stress, some coping, you know, de-stressing, some coping techniques that are useful on the fly. I guess my main concern would sort of be that the people that sort of would be offering these or would likely to be offering these probably don't necessarily have the appropriate skills or training to really pick up on. If there's someone that's kind of been encouraged to do this in the workplace, they may not have the skills to sort of pick up if there's more going on for that individual and if they sort of probably should step out or not do that training.
And Craig, what are your concerns about that idea that this thing that might be a task that you're meant to do at work can bleed over into your personal time? Because some of them suggest that you continue the practice at home. Effectively, you're doing your homework, or you might not be getting the full effects, or even letting the side down with your teammates.
Well, I expect that's just, that in a workplace, you can have people attend a presentation to learn a bit about it, to dip their toe into a practical experience of it. But what people choose to do outside of work has to be very much up to them and their own personal choice. Now, of course, if somebody finds benefit from it, or if it creates interest, if the person feels that they have a need and this might be helpful, then they're highly likely to start to use some of the strategies, whether they do the meditation practice or start to practice being more mindful in their day-to-day life. They will take it up and use it at home. You know, many people will say, I punctuate my day with lots of little commas, little one-minute practice here you're there. For example, I turn off the car when I get home. I just have a half minute to settle myself, to just be present, so that when I walk into the house, I'm present to the kids, I'm present to the partner, and engaged, and not taking the baggage from a day's work into the home. So people will, I think, apply it outside of work if they feel that there's value for them. But at the end of the day, nobody can or should try and force a person to practice something that they haven't really connected with.
So, Craig, you're an ambassador for Smiling Mind, a wellness organisation which has apps and does workplace programs. But when it's so easy to make claims that a particular brand of mindfulness is effective, why are you confident about the claims that Smiling Mind makes?
Well, I think that when things are said about how it can help, it's drawn from a large body of literature, and we do need to be careful and over time nuance the message about what helps and what doesn't. There's an increasing body of evidence to show that various online programs and apps can have benefits in certain ways. There's always going to be a need for further evidence. And so the claims are made from a very broad view of the literature, and offering something. And Smiling Mind, I think they're a wonderful team of people. It's a philanthropic group. It's a free app. It's not a commercial venture where people at Smiling Mind are trying to make money out of making these claims. They're actually people who really resonate with it in their own life, who want this to be available to people in the wider community within Australia and outside. And but at the same time, always, I think, and I suspect Nicholas would agree, that you need more research to see exactly how much it helps in what sorts of ways. And that's a new frontier, I think, in further research.
I'm wondering if the topic of mindfulness has come up in a work context for you. Leave a message on our Facebook page if it has, especially if your boss has paid for you to do a mindfulness course. Has it made a difference in your life? Nicholas, what are your thoughts about how mindfulness programs might contribute to workplace culture? Could it be a positive step that the employer is saying, we value a workplace that promotes employee well-being? Or are there dangers that could shift over into, we're doing this so that you don't get sick and you're more productive, and that's the culture we would like to see?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the company's goals. I think there is the potential for it to sort of be helpful and to sort of create a better and more wholesome or more integrative workplace environment where people are happier and sort of not taking their work home with them, so to speak. But there also, I think, is that possibility of it being used as a way for employers to sort of to reduce absenteeism, to reduce sort of decreases in productivity associated with people being sick and ill. I think there's also a possibility for it to be used as a way of sort of saying, don't worry about the fact that we're underpaying you, or we're not providing sort of the resources that you need to do your job. Just take a breath and sort of take it with ease, and sort of, and so there is this, I think, potential or capacity for it to be used as a tool, kind of sort of suppressing people's desire to sort of revolt against what the sort of hierarchy is sort of demanding that they do on a day-to-day basis.
Wow, mindfulness is a tool for oppressing the masses. That's an angle I have not heard before. Craig, you use mindfulness when you're teaching your medical students at Monash University. Yes. How do they react to this idea?
Well, we've found from the research we've published that 90% of the students say by the end of the program they're personally applying it in their own lives. And as I was saying before, it has to be up to the students. So we offer it as a part of the core curriculum. The mindfulness is integrated into a mindfulness-based lifestyle program. And the way that we approach it for the students is that they learn about lifestyle change, they learn about mindfulness approaches to cultivating well-being or a greater ability to engage with their study, etc., so that they understand how these kinds of things could be helpful one day for their patients if used appropriately, but also that we hope that it benefits their health and well-being. We've published a series of papers. What we've found from our students is that the great majority say they personally use it outside of tutorial time because it helps them. And secondly, we've found that rather than the increases in stress and depression, anxiety that medical students in particular often report, we find the opposite of that. After they've had the program, even in the high stress periods of semester, like immediately pre-exam, they've got better than mental health and well-being than they had in the low stress period of semester, and they're more engaged with their study, etc. But occasionally students, I mean, there are clearly students who have mental health issues. Some of the students struggle with mindfulness, and we don't push them to practice something they're not comfortable with. And the tutors are all trained health professionals who, if there's ever any student struggling, you only apply what you're comfortable to apply, and make sure that that student is linked up with appropriate support services for more individualised care.
That sounds like an ideal context in which to do that. Just before we finish, Nicholas, I want to ask you, what sort of research would you like to see happen around mindfulness?
I think there's a desperate need to kind of explore this idea that apps can actually make a substitute for, or can be substituted for, face-to-face or in-person meditation instruction. I think there's been a lot of bold claims that these apps can be the thing that sort of, and it's the same thing in mental health as well. You see the rollout of a lot of apps in the place of face-to-face interventions. And that makes economic sense. It's, you know, there are places where it's hard to get people to. But I think before we do that kind of thing, we really need to know, like, is this actually a substitute? Or maybe is it an augmentative tool? Is it helping people to do the things that we need them to do? Is it a way of sort of helping the face-to-face interventions, identifying who most desperately needs those face-to-face care? So that's a really important thing. The other thing is that dose response thing, and what I mean by that is how much of the practice should they do before they start to see benefits. So we don't know that right now. We sort of say 8 weeks roughly, or we say 6 weeks, because that's sort of the ballparks. That's how things are sort of set up. And it's kind of arbitrary. We don't really know how much practice should people actually do. And we're not able to sort of sit down with people and say, look, if you're coming to meditation and mindfulness practice for this reason, then this is how much input, you know, we'd expect you to have before you really start to see it working.
It's almost as weird, the idea of putting mindfulness in a clinical research setting as in a workplace setting, but it's been a fascinating chat this morning. Thank you both.
My pleasure.
Hilary.
Dr. Nicholas Van Dam, Senior Lecturer in Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne, and Dr. Craig Hassett, Associate Professor at the Monash University Medical School and Coordinator of Mindfulness Programs at Monash University. You're listening to Life Matters